Good morning. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large for Sunday, February 9th, 2014. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. Ahead on Weekend Ozarks, we talk with the voice that brings the community together, one of the last African-American newspapers in Arkansas.
Plus, a visit to a 90-year-old father-to-son candy-making tradition just in time for Valentine's Day. And Becca Martin Brown has more on an exhibit in Fort Smith that showcases some of the best and worst Valentine's Day cards.
But first, though the legislative session begins in Arkansas in the coming week, Washington, D.C. was rife with news this past week. Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis has more in this morning's Week in Review.
It's been a busy week in Arkansas political news. This week, Republican Congressman Tim Griffin, who's stepping down at the end of his current term, said he is considering a run for Lieutenant Governor of Arkansas.
I've been talking with my wife about it, and we're considering it. It's not final, but that excites me because it would allow me to continue public service, but at the same time be in Arkansas, which is what my decision not to run for re-election to Congress is all about. I've got a 3-year-old and a 6-year-old, and being back in Arkansas would allow me to watch them grow up, which has been the challenge with Washington.
Congressman Griffin cited family concerns when he announced last year he wouldn't run for re-election. If Griffin decides to run for lieutenant governor, it would shake up the race as state representatives Charlie Collins and Andy Mayberry are already seeking the Republican nomination. Former Highway Commissioner John Burkhalter is the lone Democratic candidate, and there is no incumbent after Mark Darr stepped down earlier this year amid ethics violations. A spokeswoman for the Democratic Party of Arkansas responded to the news, saying in a statement that Tim Griffin would bring the dysfunctional politics of Washington to Arkansas. And moving on to Washington, Arkansas's U.S. senators praised Tuesday's passage of a 5-year farm bill, which was signed by President Obama on Friday. It came after extensive negotiations, with much of the debate focusing on the inclusion of food stamps in the $1 trillion bill. Speaking on the House floor, Democratic Senator Mark Pryor said the bill is vital for the agriculture industry.
We hear every day here in the United States Senate from the business community. They want more certainty. They want more stability. Well, this bill provides that in the agriculture economy. Our farmers and our producers and others, they deserve that same certainty and stability, and this bill provides that.
Republican Senator John Bozeman was part of the conference committee that negotiated the agreement between House and Senate versions of the bill. He told reporters after the vote that it was difficult.
But at the end of the day, I think we've got a really good product, something that we can all be proud of. As you know, these aren't Democrat or Republican issues to a large extent. It's making sure the various segments of agriculture are well represented throughout the various regions of the country. And again, having a situation where we don't have a one-size-fits-all in this complicated economy.
Passage in the Senate followed approval a few weeks ago in the House of Representatives. With the vote in the Senate final, 4th District Representative Tom Cotton was the only representative of Arkansas's congressional contingent to vote against the farm bill. 1 in 6 jobs in Arkansas are connected to the agriculture industry. And speaking of the Senate, the television ad war in Arkansas's Senate race is heating up. Democratic incumbent Senator Mark Pryor and a conservative group backing Republican Tom Cotton are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars each on new spots that began airing Thursday. Pryor's campaign unveiled 2 ads featuring people criticizing Cotton for supporting a plan to turn Medicare into a voucher-type system for future beneficiaries.
Retirement is just around the corner for us. That's why I was so concerned when I read Congressman Cotton voted to change Medicare into a voucher system.
The state Republican Party calls the ads misleading. Meanwhile, Americans for Prosperity, a conservative group backed by billionaire brothers Charles and David Koch, announced ads will begin running criticizing Pryor for supporting the federal health care overhaul.
Millions of people can't see their own doctors, and millions are paying more and getting less. Obamacare doesn't work. It just doesn't work.
The ad targeting Senator Pryor is virtually identical to one that began airing this week in North Carolina that targets Democratic Senator Kay Hagan. According to a report by the City Wire, although this Senate race may turn out to be the most expensive political campaign in Arkansas history, some political consultants question whether the current round of political advertisements is connecting with voters. And finally, officials with the Arkansas Department of Human Services say the federal government cannot stop the state from ending the so-called private option. Testimony about the state's unique approach to expanding Medicaid was part of a legislative committee meeting this week and came in advance of the start of this year's fiscal session. Lawmakers are considering cutting funding for the program, which was approved last year. Speaking earlier in the week with Roby Brock of Talk Business Arkansas, Governor Mike Beebe said cutting the private option would put an $89 million hole in the state's budget.
I still believe in the legislative process. I still think the legislature is going to deal with logic and money and arithmetic, as I say, or as Clinton used to say. The ideology is one thing, and you can hate Obamacare and you can hate what they're doing in Washington. What Arkansas did in a bipartisan manner, Republicans and Democrats leading together, is to take something and make something better out of it. It's the alternative to the strict Obamacare.
Continuing the private option will require a 3/4 vote by state lawmakers, a vote that Governor Beebe says will be close.
When you've got to get 75%, in each house, that's 75 out of 100 House members, 27 out of 35 senators. That's tough to get for just about anything, much less something that might be controversial. And so the loss of one vote here or one vote there puts a lot of stuff in jeopardy or a lot of stuff in peril.
But the governor said that he's optimistic lawmakers will agree to continue the program. And the fiscal session begins tomorrow in Little Rock. And on tomorrow's edition of Daily Ozarks at Large, we'll speak with four legislators from Northwest Arkansas to preview what's ahead for this meeting of the Arkansas General Assembly. From the Harold and Blanche Kalk News Studio, I'm Timothy Dennis, and this is Weekend Ozarks at Large.
The Lincoln Echo, published in Fort Smith, appears to be the last of a long list of African American newspapers in Arkansas. As Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, the paper has historic roots and is branded as the voice that brings the community together.
Fort Smith counts an estimated 8,000 African American residents, nearly 10% of the city's population, the second largest black population in western Arkansas after Texarkana. And Fort Smith's black district is growing, up 10% over the past decade. Cecil M. Green Jr. was raised in Fort Smith. He moved away to attend college and worked as an administrator at the University of Chicago and registrar in Knoxville, Tennessee. He retired and moved back to Fort Smith after being away 50 years. Now 81 years old, Cecil Green continues to work as executive vice president of the Lincoln Echo.
When I came to Fort Smith, the Lincoln Echo became available, if you will, and Napoleon Black and two other individuals, they decided on it, and I said, hey, I'd like to become a part of it. And so I did become a part of the operation because I lived here in Fort Smith, and the other three people involved in it lived, two of them lived in California. Napoleon lives in St. Louis, and he commutes down here once a month to put the paper together.
The Lincoln Echo premiered in 1992 as a popular newsletter for the alumni of Lincoln High School, Fort Smith's historic African-American secondary school, which served the region's black children during segregation. The Echo was produced by Sherry Tolliver and Barbara Meadows. Cecil Green is a member of the class of 1948, and his father served as longtime principal.
That was the only education that they could have gotten. And just as a note, the kids from Fayetteville came down. They would spend the entire week in Fort Smith in selected homes, and they would go home on weekends. We also had some students. We were right here on the Oklahoma line, who walked across the Garrison Avenue Bridge, walked across the Arkansas River from Moffitt to go to school here in Fort Smith.
When Tolliver and Meadows decided to sell their newsletter, Napoleon Black, Cecil Green, and several others purchased the brand in 2001, transforming it into a regional newspaper.
Well, we are available to citywide and statewide. Primarily in Fort Smith, we are targeting the African American community, and one of our goals is to keep people informed about what is going on within our community.
The news office is based at Brunswick Place on 10th Street in downtown Fort Smith. Cecil Green says the paper is bipartisan, but editorially left-leaning.
We try to keep our readers informed about where we've been, where we've come from as a group, and what's going on in the political world.
The Lincoln Echo reprints national and international articles of African American interest. The paper does not cover crime or breaking news, but prints political, civic, cultural, and historical content, including African tribal history, NAACP news, college graduate profiles, and obituaries in the community.
For example, the church community is very important here in Fort Smith, and we get a lot of people say, will you publicize this event for us, or will you cover this event for us?
The paper has an array of columnists. Aileen Stafford, newspaper office manager, writes about UAFS and current events. Ad manager Danae Burris writes opinion pieces. Tana Holloman, noted Van Buren African American genealogist, writes a heritage column. The newspaper's politics section features columns by Senators John Bozeman and occasionally Mark Pryor. And each month, Arkansas Governor Mike Beebe submits a column. Fort Smith City Director Andre Good, who's African American, writes a page titled, Where Do We Stand? Regarding City Politics. The Van Buren Press Argus, owned by the Southwest Times Record, prints the paper paid for by ad revenue. It has a circulation of 3,000. Papers are for sale in places around Fort Smith, as well as in a half dozen newspaper boxes in Little Rock for 50 cents. Subscriptions are $25 a year. The Echo has an online edition and is now on Facebook.
We get quite a few hits, as the terminology goes, from our online edition. And I might mention on the online edition, it is constantly updated.
More than 30 Black-owned newspapers have launched in Arkansas over the past 145 years. The Arkansas Freeman began publication in the summer of 1869 and is considered the first. But the most noted is the Arkansas State Press, established in Little Rock in 1941 by civil rights pioneers Lucius Christopher Bates and Daisy Gadsden Bates. It remained in circulation until 1997. And like Fort Smith's Lincoln Echo, the Arkansas State Press was the voice of Little Rock Central High during the desegregation crisis of 1957. 13 Black newspapers were published in Van Buren and Fort Smith between 1898 and present time. Nationwide, several African American dailies exist, most notably the Chicago Defender. Now, Napoleon Black believes Black-owned media is critical. He's publisher and co-owner of the Lincoln Echo. He was born and raised in Fort Smith and also attended Lincoln High, graduating in 1959.
It was a self-sustaining community with segregation being the prevalent political, that's the way everything was done. And you had, as in a lot of ethnic communities, money would and businesses were tailored towards their clientele, and it was self-sustaining, and money would circulate there three, four, five times before it ever left the community. There were five doctors in Fort Smith, five Black doctors in Fort Smith. There was a dentist. There was drug stores. There was all types of businesses. And actually, with integration, all of those businesses went away.
Napoleon Black lives out of state and is retired from AT&T, where he worked as an accounts manager in marketing. He said being raised in a segregated society spurred intense determination amongst his demographic and the desire towards excellence.
And that was the thing that was instilled in us. And at that time, there was an explosion of people, first people that lived in these communities going to college and returning from college and getting jobs. And I know my older brother, when the first job that he got, he made twice the salary that my father made. And that was because of education. And those were practical things that you could see the results of what education would do. So that was an incentive to go to school and get that. My father was a practical man. He took all his boys down. He was a red cap, which was a person who carried bags for Continental Trailway. And he took us down and had us sit and watch him for 4 hours. He took us down in the morning and just watch him. This is what he did. He said, now, you can go to school and you can do better than I am, or you cannot go to school and I'll get your job right here.
Publisher Napoleon Blackpen's Poe's thoughts on the editorial page. His brother, the late Alan Black, a prominent Fort Smith resident, served as columnist and editor. As for Cecil Green, his most memorable newspaper issue was the opportunity to cover in person the inauguration of Barack Obama as 44th President of the United States on January 20th, 2009.
We were just very proud of that issue, that edition that we have. And I think we have it posted on a wall down there in the office.
The Lincoln Echo, reporting on history in the making. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
You can read the online edition at thelincolnecho.com.
Later today on This American Life, when the new girl showed up at high school, Justin fell hard.
Oh, man, you know, she was mature in the body-wise because she was older than what she was saying.
Yeah, much older. Because Justin's new crush was an undercover cop. Which Justin didn't know when he asked her to the prom. Love stirs people and what they do for love. Later today.
It begins this morning at 10 on KUAF.
This is Ozarks at Large. Echo Sibley has plenty to say and sing about in her one-woman show, Flippin' Channels in the Estrogen Zone. She uses language, sometimes risque, to ponder about sexuality, sex, and relationships. The longtime resident of Fayetteville, she has 3 degrees from the University of Arkansas, has spent the past 15 months in Italy working on the production and will perform it Sunday and Monday nights at the Stolen Glass in Fayetteville and again on Valentine's Night at Caribe Restaurant and Cantina in Eureka Springs. Echo recently came to KUAF and she told Katie Hendrickson the current play, which has been featured at the Chicago Sketch Comedy Festival, began when she was trying to revise an earlier one-woman script she wrote while at the University of Arkansas.
And the show just got worse and worse. And finally, Bob Ford, who everyone knows in Fable, who's an amazing playwright and director and one of my professors at the University of Arkansas, said, okay, what kind of show do you want to write? And I said, I just want to write something really funny. I just want to laugh at myself. I want to laugh at these situations. I want to take something that to me was very difficult and painful and just have a good time with it. Like kind of like when you have a glass of wine with a girlfriend and you're talking and you're laughing about the insane things that happen on dates. I wanted it to have that feel and sort of have that sketch comedy Saturday Night Live feel. And he said, okay, good, go home and figure out how to write it. And I went, okay. And I got inspired that night about the idea of flipping channels on a television. And so with that, I felt like I had all this freedom because I could do anything. It's like just changing the channel. So I came up with the idea of flipping channels in the estrogen zone and sort of this play on the twilight zone. And because I think relationships can be so bizarre, like you are stuck in the twilight zone. So I wrote like a great deal of the show in one night and went back to class the next day and everyone was laughing and enjoying what I'd written. And I wrote the whole show in like 2.5 weeks and did it at Nadine Baum at the Walnut Center.
What was it like to come up with a one-woman show? It seems like it's a lot of pressure because it's all on you. Every single aspect's on you. And it's, in a way, it's a little bit liberating because you have all the control, but at the same time, you have to rely all on you. So tell me about that.
Well, I think you pretty much nailed it on the head. I mean, what I found it extremely freeing because I think as an actress or a singer, you deal with a lot of rejection and self-doubt and, you know, wanting to be perfect and wanting to nail it. And the thing I loved about writing my one-woman show is it's what I want. You know, my characters are what I came up with. It's like, yeah, I have full control. And yeah, it is all on you, but it's like I'm up on stage playing for an hour and I crack myself up. I just hope everyone else thinks it's funny. You know, so it's always a joy when things that made me laugh when I was writing them make other people laugh too. So I love it. Yeah, it's a lot of pressure. I mean, 1 hour on stage by yourself, my voice gets really tired and I just got over laryngitis and, you know, it's hard, but it's super, super fun, and it's like the show writes itself. I mean, all my friends and myself have a gold mine of hilarious things that have happened to us, so it's just fun. And the cool thing about it, too, is you know, I've had people say, that they really loved it and laughed, but I think it makes people think, too, because underlying there's a message, you know, to it all. So that's my goal, is to sort of shock people, make them laugh, but I want them to go home and think later. I've had a couple guys tell me they learned things, too, which I thought was good.
And let's talk a little bit specifically. You're co-opting these famous Disney songs and such and making them something else. So tell us a little bit about that and maybe specifically what songs you've used.
Yeah, well, you know, I've researched a lot about also just what is possible with parodies. You know, you have to be careful when you're taking someone else's work. You know, you don't want to do something that is not good, but the great thing about parodies, you know, you've got Weird Al Yankovic and all these people, you can do really amazing things. They need to allude to the original, which mine do. And so, you know, for me, I think growing up, one of the deals with falling in love and finding that perfect relationship and getting married and all these things that women have a lot of pressure about, and the fairy tales, is we grow up with these idealized Disney princesses and this perfect thing, and, you know, at the end the credits roll and you don't get to see where they fight over money and they, you know, whatever, do all these things. So I took things like The Little Mermaid, and what you see is it's her dating video after she's divorced her Prince Charming, you know? And so it's like her trying to find love again, and she sings It's Part of Your World is the parody. But it's called Need Not Apply, and it's her literally going, saying all the things she doesn't want this time and the things she's looking for, and it's her frustrations. I have that. And then I have a very Mary Poppins-esque character that kind of does a children's show. And so she sings like a Mr. Rogers parody, Welcome to the Neighborhood, you know, as she's getting dressed and putting on her hat, kind of like he does at the beginning of his show. But it's all about menstruation, because I think there's a lot of things, too, as we grow up, like that you don't hear about, the horror stories. You hear them sometimes, but there's other things, too, that you don't hear about. And I thought, how cool would that have been to have a children's show growing up that really, you know, laid it out there for you? And then I do a parody of Spoonful of Sugar, but it's all about sex.
I think a lot about what is taboo as far as women's topics and like menstruation and sexuality. So I guess I'm curious to hear your thoughts on why are these things considered taboo for women to talk about?
I don't know. I think maybe part of it, too, is we're in the South, so there's this like being a lady kind of thing. I mean, when I went to Chicago, I really, when I was writing this show, struggled a lot because there were things I wanted to say, and I thought, oh, I'm really pushing the envelope with that. I went to Chicago, and I was like, my show's rated G because the things they're doing there is so, I mean, it's so much more over the top than anything I do. I mean, I allude to a lot of things, but there's some language, definitely, but there I was shocked at some of the things. So I think there's a little bit of the Southern sensibilities, but it's also that idea of, you're not supposed to talk about it or something. I don't know what it is. It's a cultural thing for sure, and I don't like it. And I feel like I do like to shock people with the way I talk sometimes, but to me, it's owning myself. Like, well, somebody said something to me a long time ago that they said, if you're doing something that you can't talk about to everybody, you shouldn't be doing it. And I loved that. You know, I thought, that's so true. And I think a lot of times we do, you know, even in relationships. And also, I mean, aside from wanting to push the taboos of women and women comedians and feeling like we can own things the way men can, I also wanted to talk about the stereotypes of women. Like, there's this stereotype for women that men like sex more than women do. That the woman's always the one with the headache. The woman's always the one going, no, honey, not tonight. And in my experience, in the experience of my girlfriends, that is the opposite. You know, so I'm kind of furious about that particular stereotype. And also, you know, I see so many of my amazing, educated, cool, like accomplished friends who are so bored that they choose to date men who are terrible for them. And my show is not about men being bad. This is not a male bashing show. This is for men and women. What this show is about is people actively making choices to be in relationships that they know from the get-go are wrong and bad because they're so lonely and they feel so much pressure to be in a relationship.
Echo Sibley's one-woman play, Flippin' Channels in the Estrogen Zone, will be performed Sunday and Monday nights beginning at 8 at the Stolen Glass in Fayetteville. There are discounts for students with valid ID. She'll also perform at Caribe Restaurant and Cantina in Eureka Springs on Valentine's Night at 7. She talked with Katie Hendrickson at KUAF earlier this month.
either down Highway 62, moving east toward Eureka, or southwest to Rogers. Just outside of the small town of Gateway, you'll see something you may have seen in the motor tour days of the 1950s, a candy store, marked by a 12-foot candy cane holding the sign for Martin Greer's Candies. Inside the white building, Martin Greer II and his son Uriah are carrying on the father-son candy-making tradition that started 90 years ago.
Dad started making candy in 1924 at home on the farm, and he would take his candy to town where they lived close to Texarkana. He would take his candy when they went to sell their produce on Saturdays, and you know. So he did that mainly to get a little spending money, like most teenagers would, you know. They like to have a little spending money, and if you live on the farm, you don't get it.
That next year, Martin Sr. went to work for a candy company in Texarkana, learning the trade from two Greek candy makers and several others over the next few years. After taking a hiatus from candy making during World War II, he opened Mrs. Greer's Candies. As a teenager, Martin recalls his father telling him, "You need a trade, and because I'm a candy maker, you're going to be a candy maker." And in just a couple of years, he was cooking up to 500 pounds of candy each day.
The first 6 years that Silver Dollar City was in existence, from 1960 to 1965, I made it at Dad's place and then took it up there. In fact, it was, I considered it a sort of a vacation or a break just to get away from the candy shop and deliver it. But I was also going to school.
In 1965, Greer got his bachelor's degree and went on to teach art for Van Buren Public Schools. He maintained the two careers for much of his 75 years, cooking candy long after his father's death, after school, and on the weekends. His wife and her mother working the candy store while Greer taught. The two are still very instrumental in the family business, in this location that opened in 2000. Martin Greer III declined to become a candy maker. However, he did carry on the teaching gene. It is Greer's 23-year-old son, Uriah, who does much of the cooking these days. Health problems keeping Martin from lifting much and from standing over hot pots of potential candies. In a long room behind glass cases that hold shelves of chocolate-covered cherries, almond toffee, nut clusters, caramel tempters, and over 200 varieties, three banks of tables can be seen. Sunk into the tops of each are what appear to be large metal mixing bowls. In the center of each bowl is a partition separating one side of liquid melted chocolate from an empty one, a wand stirring the melted chocolate and clearing the side of the other.
Okay, this is what is called a tempering pot. You put the cold chocolate in on one side, and it will mix with the warm chocolate on the other side and gets it just to the right temperature where we can dip the centers in there.
Each pot of chocolate holds something different, a dark, a white, a milk, and a sugar-free. The temperatures for each are also different depending on the type, but all gauges lit up in red under the table surface read somewhere over 90 degrees. This cold room, though, is just that, the temperature never going over 65 degrees, no matter the weather. The optimum temperature for setting the hand-dipped chocolates and for the unmelted. The tempering pots are also dipping pots.
We dip not with our hands anymore down into the chocolate, but we use a dipping fork.
Using a wide-pronged fork of sorts, Greer drops a center or nougat to be covered in the milky brown goodness. This is what he calls hand-dipping, a process that hasn't been used much since the 1950s, when the process was mechanized with the advent of an enrober. The Greers have one such machine, yet haven't used it in over 8 years. Pretty much anything from a cherry to a marshmallow can be covered in the Peters brand chocolate.
Peters is the one who invented milk chocolate in Switzerland in 1875. We use only Peter's chocolate.
According to Peter's Chocolate's website, in 1867, Daniel Peter first attempted to make dark chocolate less bitter by adding milk. But it wasn't until several years later, in 1875, that a partnership with his neighbor Henry Nestle led to a variety using powdered milk. Everything from Greer's fondant to the caramel is made in the candy kitchen, a room that can be accessed by leaving the dipping room, passing through a packaging room and a storage area, and down just one step into a large room with windows. Windows that overlook the parking lot and down to Highway 62. Nothing but trees on the other side. Next to the window stands a 99-year-old taffy puller, used mainly in the summer months. From the opposite ceiling and wall hangs a large vent hood over three copper pots that vary in size. Each rests atop a raised gas burner. The largest, a 75-year-old fire mixer.
Recently it's called a fire mixer. It cooks and it mixes at the same time. So we use that mainly for caramel. The small kettles we use for other things. So last night my son cooked almond toffee, and that kettle hadn't been cleaned yet, nor has the slab been cleaned yet, but it'll be cleaned this morning.
Chocolate-covered almond toffee, made with only pure ingredients, happens to be one of the Greer's best sellers. When it has been fully cooked in the kettle, it is moved from the burner and poured onto the slab in the center of the room, the candy maker simply having to turn around. The toffee is then left to rest and harden until it is scored and cut into rectangular pieces to be covered in chocolate. Cream centers are also made in one of the copper candy kettles. When they are cooked, however, the small batch of about 20 pounds is poured into one of two cream beaters, a machine resembling a very large KitchenAid stand-up mixer.
It has to be spotless instantly. It cannot be even a little speck of sugar in there because it can turn the whole batch back to sugar. Well, both of these are probably about 113, 114 years old. Now, the motors are not that old. We've had to replace the motors.
The recipes are even older, with many of them traceable to the 1890s, though refining and changing to customers' tastes is an ongoing process. All are small batch, hand-dipped, and never frozen. He says that many boxes made by national companies have been frozen for up to 3 years before they're finally picked up off of store shelf. And if you slice into one of theirs, you'll see just a small layer of chocolate over the center. Greer sweets, however, are 50% chocolate. The number one seller is a turtle-like sweet the Greers call Tempters. Greer, however, says he personally has no favorite.
I'm the kid who grew up in the candy shop, and I can have a different one every day.
And in the lobby of this candy store, the Greers are preparing for Valentine's Day. Tables are arranged with red and pink heart-shaped boxes. Some sweets for your sweet. It's a quiet morning at this location just outside of Gateway. And 6 days a week, Martin Greer drives to a Bentonville location, one that just opened up in November. The hope is to grow the business so that young sons Uriah, the current candy maker, and 14-year-old Joseph will be able to carry on this father-to-son tradition. It doesn't take long after Martin opens the doors to this store, which is located in a shopping center just a couple of blocks west of the downtown Bentonville Square, for customers to start strolling in. And the short time I was there, I saw three, one of whom had this to say.
I had this candy in December for the first time.
Oh.
Best candy I've ever had.
You get that?
I did.
You were the TV?
Radio, with the public radio station with KUAF.
They got great candy.
For more information or to shop, visit martingreerscandies.com. Remember that Martin Greer II was also an art teacher. The walls in both stores are lined with his paintings and cartoons, some of which were printed in publications such as the Southwest Times Record. Listen for more about Martin Greer's art career on a coming edition of Ozarks at Large.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Ahead later on the program, I Love Lucy on stage at Walton Arts Center.
Yep, she'll be there this afternoon.
A television classic.
Yes.
50 years ago tonight, television history was made.
That's right.
The Beatles, for the first time ever, were on the Ed Sullivan Show.
It's kind of when the Beatles came to America, right?
It is, yes. Yeah. Yes, it was a huge, huge event. I was alive, but I don't remember.
That's what I was
gonna. A few months old.
Yeah.
So for this week's montage, I didn't want to do the Beatles because that's been done. And I was looking around. Well, the host, the man who brought the Beatles onto television, was, of course, Ed Sullivan. Now, do you have a recollection of Ed Sullivan at all?
A little bit, yes. Okay. Yeah, yeah. He's a classic, too.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And so I thought for this Sunday's montage, we'd use his initials, ES. And so, and this one gets a bit obscure, admittedly. Here is our montage salute to the initials ES.
Now, yesterday and today, our theater's been jammed with newspapermen and hundreds of photographers from all over the nation. And these veterans agree with me that the city never has witnessed the excitement stirred by these youngsters from Liverpool who call themselves the Beatles. Now, tonight, you're going to twice be entertained by them. Right now and again in the second half of our show. Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles! That's...
Goodbye.
Center.
Seriously? It's like you're photoshopped.
La 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 la.
What I want to do, basically, is to attempt to target my thinking to the three of you. Would you stand, please? The three of you who've cited cards. I'm not going to even reshuffle the deck. I have here a blackboard, and I will number it 1, 2, and 3. Now I elude my attention to those three who are standing. Would you concentrate, please?
Hello, sweetheart.
Hey, Dad. Mom and Dad, this is Daniel Russo, and these are my parents, Mr. and Mrs. Mills.
Well, how do you do, Daniel?
Oh, hi.
Hello, Daniel.
Nice to meet you.
Where are you going, honey?
Oh, I don't know. Where are we going?
Okay, if you want to, there are some that you might identify and go, wait, what? How is that related to ES? If you want to see the rationale as well as the list of the clips we used, you can go online to ozarksatlarge.com.
You explain it.
Yeah, the ones okay. I think need explaining. Okay. I mean, certain ones.
Okay. Is Eureka Springs in there?
No, that's one okay. of the apologies.
Okay.
But I explained what I would have done with Eureka Springs okay. and why I didn't, because it would have just been too hard to tell.
Okay.
Are you familiar with the movie Pass the Ammo?
No.
Okay, there you go. I made the right choice.
Well, the classic television sitcom I Love Lucy debuted in 1951, and reruns of the show can still be seen today. The show has also been the inspiration for a new theater production that's been on stage at the Walton Arts Center since Tuesday night. Earlier this week, Bill Mendieta, one of the actors in I Love Lucy live on stage, stopped by Studio 123 to talk to Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda. During that conversation, Bill, who portrays Ricky Ricardo, discussed how the sitcom was a groundbreaking show.
It was the first show that was done in front of a live audience with that three-camera shoot that they use in sitcoms today. And so that, in fact, we went to see a taping of Last Man Standing, mm-hmm. which is which Kim Flagg's a writer on, and we got they're doing the same thing, the exact same thing that they did at Desilu. with the host. At the first, Desi was the host and would introduce the audience.
Okay.
But then they got, what they do today is get comics and people that's their job to warm up the audience, bring them there, get that energy up. So it mirrors a theater experience. So the actors and the audience get that experience there so we can have real laughter. And they can capture that sound in the cameras, and that makes it for a good experience when you watch it on TV. And because back in that day, they recorded TV shows live. They recorded it from New York, then had a 3-hour delay feed, and it had to put it on Kinescope, which basically is putting a film camera to a TV screen and seeing that. So the quality's not as good, and they rebroadcast that in Los Angeles. I Love Lucy was groundbreaking because they filmed it, and they filmed it like a movie in a way, mm-hmm. but with three cameras, and sometimes movies did that with multiple cameras. But they filmed it so the quality was pristine, so they could edit it together and then release it, and then 3 hours later release it again and still have the same quality. And that was groundbreaking for the time and set the tone.
Well, you mentioned getting the rights from CBS. Was that a difficult process? Because I feel like with something like I Love Lucy, that's such a cultural, pop culture icon that people might be a little hesitant to share that with someone.
Yeah, and the producers took them about maybe 10 years after they had that idea with the to put it up on stage to develop that to relationship with CBS. They had actually toured the memorabilia of I Love Lucy back, I think, 2001, when it was the 50th anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
They recreated the sets and toured it around to state fairs and all. And they were amazed by how many millions of people went through it and were excited by it. And then they had the idea, what if we put actors on these sets? What if we can recreate these episodes? Would there be an audience for that? And so they courted CBS for years to finally allow them the rights to these episodes. And now we have the rights to all 179 episodes, and they were able to, and that's why the development of this was important, to see if this concept would work, if CBS would approve and like it, what we're doing with it. And they were involved from the beginning. They had approval on the casting and approval on the scripts and what came to the early shows to make sure, oh, good, it works. This is what they want. It's representing the show and CBS in a good way. And we're actually, this is a love letter to I Love Lucy and to classic television. And that's what Rick Sparks, our director, had mentioned, and it still rings true that, that was a really good show, and we're doing our best to present it and honor it for people to see and give fans of the show an experience that they never might have had before. What would it have been like to be there then, to see these characters and these actors? So they see in between the scenes, and they can just witness the dynamics of what happens. And we do it in a very loving way, so we hope it's entertaining for everyone.
That was actor Bill Mendieta talking to Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda about I Love Lucy Live on Stage. That conversation took place in Studio 123 earlier this week. The final show at Walton Arts Center is this afternoon at 2. More information available at waltonartcenter.org.
It is Sunday, February 9th, 2014. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
And here with us now is Becca Martin Brown. She is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
More about Valentine's Day.
All right.
But with a twist.
Ooh.
There's an exhibit called Valentine's, The Art of Romance, which is at the Fort Smith Regional Art Museum.
I've seen a few of these, and they look fun.
Oh, there's lots of beautiful Valentines from the heyday when they folded out and stood up on their own, or they were made with lace or all sorts of intricate cutting techniques.
Not just Hallmark.
But then there are the others.
Mm.
The rude, insulting, very popular at the turn of the 20th century Valentines. Here's the verse from one.
Okay.
in fancy jersey button tight with hair so close, so coarse and frowsy, you look just like a kitchen maid or cook, so fat and blousy. Mm-hmm. Go take it off in face and form. You're like a dressed up sow. Or when you try to walk around a clumsy jersey cow.
That's not very nice.
And no.
These were sent, though, with tongue in cheek?
I don't know. People were really unhappy about them in England in the mid-19th century because things were sent COD.
So you would pay and then get a rude Valentine.
Exactly. You got it. You paid for it. And then you found out that it was – and the illustration for that particular one is horrible.
Well, I saw a picture of one that was basic. It just said, "Your unkindness has made me," and then it had a watermelon, and then it said collie. So, "Your unkindness has made me melancholy," which I thought was,
sad.
So, if you're one of those people, you know, they have the anti-Valentine's things. Mm-hmm. If you're one of those people, you can go to this exhibit and get your fill of this sort of thing.
Yes. You can be anti-Valentine, but you don't have to be mean.
Well, no. I'm not advocating being
mean. Okay. All right.
But you can go and do your anti-Valentine thing.
Gotcha.
Or you can go and do the nice, sweet, happy Valentines with all of the pretty accoutrements that go with them.
And they're all there.
And they're all there together through April. Hours are 11 to 6 Thursday through Saturday and 1 to 5 on Sunday. And the museum is now free.
Yeah. At any time.
And so also available for your romantic family fun this afternoon, Family Sunday, I Heart Art, from noon to 5 at Crystal Bridges in Bentonville. There will be music and art projects and fun in the galleries for everybody. And the last performance of I Love Lucy live on stage, 2 o'clock at the Walton Art Center in Fayetteville. And the only matinee of Death Trap is at 3 o'clock at the Art Center of the Ozarks in Springdale. And tickets for adults are $20.
All right. Becca Martin Brown is features editor, Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
How important are bees?
Bees are vital to the pollination and production of our fruits and vegetables. Squash, melons, pumpkins, cucumbers.
There's just one problem.
Unfortunately, they're all in trouble.
Everything is connected, from bees to toads to wolves to you. That's on the next TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Stay tuned to KUAF. TED begins today at noon on 91.3 FM.
Tomorrow night, there will be quite the free concert as a tribute to Pete Seeger in downtown Fayetteville.
Lots of local musicians taking part.
That's right. Among those scheduled to appear, Still on the Hill, Smokey and the Mirror, that's Brian and Bernice Hembry, two-thirds of...
Three Penny Acre.
Right, but... Right now, for this year, they're Smokey and the Mirror, a duo. The duo Heirloom. Two members of the band Don't Stop Please, Adam Cox and Jack Williams, will all be there singing songs that Pete Seeger either wrote or helped popularize.
Do you have a favorite?
I do. Yes.
Yeah? May I ask what it is?
Yes. It's We Shall Overcome.
Okay.
Which he didn't write, of course, but did help popularize and spread.
So I'm losing the name of it, but the song that's the intro, the theme music to Parenthood?
Yes. Oh, Parenthood.
Yeah.
That's a Bob Dylan song.
Is it? Oh.
Well, I
Forever
thought you
Young.
Forever. Well, I thought you were going to mention Little Boxes, which served as the theme to Weeds. Yes, and was and has been recorded by many different people. Again, he didn't write it, but he helped popularize it. Well, many of the people who are going to be there tomorrow night at Nightbird Books at 6 o'clock, no cover charge, it's absolutely free, it's a sing-along. Many of the people who are going to be playing came to the Furman Garner Performance Studio earlier this week, and we kind of had a conversation about what Pete Seeger meant to them, and they sang some songs. So here, singing If I Had a Hammer, are Kelly Mulholland, Jackson Jennings, Anna Horton, Joel Ludford, and Adam Cox.
All right, If I Had a Hammer... Everybody sing along now. If I had a hammer, I'd hammer in the morning, I'd hammer in the evening, all over this land. I'd hammer out danger, I'd hammer out warning, I'd hammer out a love between my brothers and my sisters, oh, over this land. If I had a bell,
it in the evening all over this land. I'd ring out danger, I'd ring out warning, I'd ring a lot of love between my brothers and my sisters. Oh, 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 over this land. If I had a song, I'd sing it in the morning, I'd sing it in the evening, all over this land. I'd sing out of danger, I'd sing out a warning, I'd sing out of love between my brothers and my sisters. I got a song to sing all over this land. It's a hammer of justice, it's the bell of freedom. It's a song about a love between my brothers and my sisters. Oh, over this land, all over this land, all over this land, all over this land.
If I Had a Hammer, as performed by Kelly Mulholland, Jackson Jennings, Anna Horton, Joel Ludford, Adam Cox. The concert will be tomorrow night at 6 at Nightbird Books on Dixon Street in Fayetteville with all of the people we just heard, plus many more. It's, as I mentioned, free. It'll be a sing-along. They'll have booklets there. Should be a great time.
It's a good chance to see a lot of local musicians.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Doing songs that you know or you don't realize you know, and it's going to be a lot of fun.
Right. Well, this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Beattie.
Beattie?
Yes.
Where is Beattie?
It is northwest of Gravette in Benton County, almost to Oklahoma and Missouri. So
oh,
it's
near the
right
tri-corner. Near
mm-hmm.
the, wow.
It's right
okay.
there in the corner, yeah.
Beattie.
Mm-hmm.
I like it.
Well, the Beatles, you know, they're celebrating.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Very good.
It's closest I could find.
Very good. Eureka House Concerts in Eureka Springs has announced that John Vesner will open the spring concert season. That's coming up the 16th. He is a Grammy winner, and opening for him will be Catherine Reed. If you'd like more information, 244-0123, or you can go online to eurekahouseconcerts.com.
The Sugar Creek Model Train and Historical Society Incorporated presents the 11th annual Great Northwest Arkansas Model Train Show February 22nd at Holiday Inn Northwest Arkansas Convention Center in Springdale. Reduce ticket price with the donation of a non-perishable food item. For more, trainshow-nwa.org.
Have you ever been to that?
I haven't.
It's so fun. I have no interest in putting together a train set.
I did it as a kid.
But I love looking at other people's. Mm-hmm. And there are some elaborate, and it's great. It's a lot of fun. The Fly Fishing Film Tour, which is one of the biggest, most entertaining events on the fly fishing calendar, I guess, that you can do inside. Wouldn't you rather fly fish?
Probably.
But
probably.
If you can, and this takes you all across the country, it's coming back to Fayetteville. It's the third consecutive year, March 3rd and 4th at Malco Razorback Cinema in Fayetteville. Discount tickets are available at McClellan's Fly Shop in Fayetteville.
And this is a pretty big deal. The Fayetteville Public Library Foundation will host an evening with Dr. Maya Angelou. It's part of the Roberta Fulbright Distinguished Author Series. The event is Friday, April 11th at the Fayetteville Public Library. The event is free and open to the public. The doors will open at 6:30 p.m., but seating is going to be limited.
Yeah.
More event details will be available March 1st on the library website, faylib.org.
Many, many people excited about that.
The library tries to also, they have screens all over the place.
Yes,
and, you know, even if you
can get in, mm-hmm, right.
Even if you can't get into the room,
right.
They'll
absolutely
make sure you can see it.
Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
I'll have a brand new show tomorrow at noon on KUAF.
Thanks so much for listening. Have a good Sunday.